Five, four, three, two, one. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Art of Move podcast with myself, Anthony Manuel, my good friend, Dr. William Raybar. We're still out here in the Canadian Rockies trying to find the grand unified theory of human movement, biomechanics, movement, functional training, all that fun stuff. And today we are joined by someone who I've been stoked to talk to. We are joined by Anne Huang, who is a movement and parkour coach passionate about helping people feel safe and confident in their bodies so that they are ready for their next adventure. Anne uses breathing, strength training, movement coaching, and parkour to teach clients and students about their bodies and teach strategies to achieve freedom of movement. And I was really pumped to talk to you specifically about some of your applications of some of the functional training systems that we've covered on this show in something that is dynamic and demanding in terms of the force exerted on your body, like parkour. I feel like there's a lot of strategies of energy transference, but also of tissue durability that you would have to, you know, basically have access to when you're doing things like jumping off a freaking building. And doing some of the movements that are, you know, like these very dynamic athletic movements that are associated with parkour. I'd love to know a little bit about your story and how you got into it and what kind of led you to seek out some of the functional training approaches, just to get right into it.
Yeah, for sure. So growing up, I had a background in gymnastics. I did competitive gymnastics for a little bit until I was in about middle school. From there, I did more traditional sports like basketball, track and field. In track and field, I found that I really loved jumping. Like, I did the high jump, triple jump, and the long jump. But for whatever reason, I was really bad at long jump and really good at high jump. My long jump was, no kidding, it was only around 10 or 11 feet. It was really bad. I don't really remember why it was so bad. But my high jump, I could jump my height. Like, I could jump 5'4". But because I'm on the shorter side, it couldn't quite get to a higher level because I was a little on the smaller side. Moving on from there, when I went to college, I played D1 rugby, and that's kind of where I got into strength training, because we had to go be in the weight room twice a week and be on the field twice a week. Post college, I worked at Equinox as a personal trainer, and that's where I got a good baseline of the way that I train, or the way that I used to train. And I wanted to find a recreational sport after college, and I tried rugby for maybe 2 weeks or so, and I was just getting tired of getting hit. I'm not a large person, and people have dump trucked me on the field, and I was getting tired of feeling like I got hit by a train after a game. When I was in the gym at Equinox, I really enjoyed jumping around, so you would see me jumping from like box to box, and then my coworkers would joke around and be like, oh, like, you should be on American Ninja Warrior. And so I Googled American Ninja Warrior gym. And then that's when the first parkour gym that I went to, called Tempest Free Running Academy, I started taking classes there. I took classes there for about 4 years until about the pandemic hit. And then post that, I started to train more on my own. But when I started parkour, I was doing a lot of running and jumping and a lot of weightlifting because I was working at the gym. I was probably strength training 5 days a week. And I noticed that my knee started to really bother me when I jumped. And that hasn't really happened to me before. And at the time, I was only, 22 years old. And then no one could really tell me the reason why my knee was hurting. I would do the PT exercises. I would roll out, I would floss every single thing I tried, and it just wasn't very, it just didn't work. And so that got me started on like this alternative biomechanic functional fitness type of world, where I bounced into, in 2019, I got into GOTA, and that kind of opened my eyes to like all of the different systems that we see now, like GOTA, functional patterns, WEC method, flowability, and all of those types of things. Once I got into GOTA, I wanted to explore a little bit more. And so my really good friend, Kasia, she introduced me to postural restoration, which has been a huge game changer for me in terms of my recovery and in terms of how I'm able to kind of make more sense of my body and more sense of the people that I work with. And that's kind of where it's gone from there. So started sports when I was young, had knee issues in my early 20s, and then got into parkour post college. And I chose parkour because I felt like it was a very it's not a natural thing to do, to jump at walls and send yourself at walls, but I thought it was a really good test of like how durable my body can be. And like, it's a fun way to work on technique, because you can have a really durable, like awesome body, but if you have bad technique in parkour, you can very, very easily get hurt. Mm.
So what was it like going into a parkour gym for the first time? Because I know, you know, the first time I went into a CrossFit gym, I'm like, whoa, this is very intimidating. And, you know, how am I ever going to get good at this type of mentality, right? And I'm sure parkour is the same type of way. So how did you progress from the very beginning? Were you picking it up fast? And what maneuvers were you able to do right off the get-go? And how did that progress?
When I first got into parkour, I progressed pretty quickly. I think it is because I had a background in gymnastics. Mm. So luckily too, at that gym and at many parkour gyms, they have classes, and many gyms structured their classes by levels, kind of like how in martial arts, you have like white belt, yellow belt, things like that. And so in a lot of parkour gyms, there's like beginners or level one, level two, level three. And so they have a curriculum where they teach you the basic movements at first, and basic movements, good techniques, good bail techniques, and then they build off from there. Off the bat, I was pretty good at just like generally getting over stuff, jumping on top of stuff. But I have some videos of my first parkour class, and man, I look really clunky. Very, very clunky.
So that clunkiness, was that just from the like a lack of technique awareness? Was that, do you think, where you had that background in weightlifting and then getting into kind of understanding, you know, weight transfer dynamics from some of the functional fitness stuff, do you think that your weightlifting tendencies kind of had an impact on the smoothness of your movement? Like, what's your take on like where that clunkiness came from?
I definitely think it was from the weightlifting that I was doing in the gym. I was essentially doing the big three, like back squat, bench press, deadlift type of thing. And although I could get good standing power, when I would put it into actual running and jumping, it just looked real funky. I felt clunky. And I think it's a lot of coordination as well. There's a lot to think about in parkour. And if you're not fully focused on the movement that you're doing, you can get hurt, which kind of led me to, I wanted to find a movement system or figure out a way for me to train so then I can really focus on my training, like my strength training at that moment. So I don't have to think about what my body is doing when I'm doing parkour, because I can't think about the way that I can't land on a certain part of my foot when I do like a big jump. I have to trust that I can move properly so I don't get hurt while I'm trying to do another dangerous thing. And so I'm all about being focused in your training, like strength training. So then when you go out and do your sport, it's not something that you think about, because that's just already way too many things to think about.
So the first time I came about you actually was on YouTube, and you were doing a quick, I think it was a go to flow or something like that. And could you kind of give a brief overview of the, you know, the systems you've done and what you took from each system as you went along? Cause I know you've probably progressed. You went go to, I think you do a little bit of OKF stuff and like Postural Restoration Institute. What attributes did you find you got from each system?
With GOTA, it was really helpful to help me see the body in a different way. Before, it was a lot of, push, pull, knee dominant, hinges, hip dominant, things like that. With GOTA, it allowed me to see the body a little bit more holistically. And that was really helpful because I can see why someone looks smoother when they did a certain movement versus another person. Mm-hmm. And it was helpful in just understanding that your body is a system and that you have to be able to work together with it all. What was a little bit difficult for me with GOTA is overthinking the movements often. And I felt like with GOTA, I went to the extremes of the spectrums, like trying to build a bigger bow or trying to get a bigger corner. And I think I lost a lot of stability in my movement, and I was just kind of flopping around. And sure, my knees didn't hurt after Gota, but I did feel a drop in performance. And I also just, when I watched my videos, I was like, man, that looks a little bit off, or that looks a little bit funky. So from there, I tried to move on to other things, but I was doing Gota for about a year and a half or 2 years. So I gave it a good go. Great people there. They're really passionate about what they do. And I found Devin or OKF stuff. I liked the stuff that he was doing. I honestly haven't taken a course from him or anything. I've had two sessions from him like way back in, I want to say like 2020 or 20. Yeah, I think June 2020. And he's really developed his system since then. But what I really like about his stuff is his idea of being able to own a neutral position and being able to be really stable in that, because when you are moving and doing explosive movements, there are external forces that are acting upon you as you're like sprinting or as you're taking a cut. And then with Gota, I kind of felt like I was off to one end. Like, imagine you're going to go for a punch and you're like wind all the way back to go all the way forward, which it maybe visually seems like it's the right thing to do, but in real application, it's too slow. And so with OKF stuff, I found a lot of being able to be stable so then I could start to do more explosive movements. I was also looking into posture restoration. I've taken 3 courses from posture restoration, and I plan to take more because I think they have a really great take on recovery and a really great take on breathing. With their stuff, it's not training. Posture restoration is not training. It's really trying to get your body into a more, a better baseline so then you can push yourself to train. It reminds me of, say you're driving a manual car, like every time you switch gears, you have to go back to neutral. With posture restoration, it helped me understand, like if I'm like always extended, I'm already in one end of the spectrum. If I do an explosive movement that requires more extension, for example, a backflip. Before, when I would do backflips, I would tweak my back because I was already kind of at the end range of stuff. And so when I would try to do the backflip, I was starting at where I was supposed to end up at. And that kind of made my body compensate in other ways and gave me some back pain. So posture restoration helped me get into a more neutral position and understanding what neutral is. And that way I feel like I can push my body now, but have the proper tools to get myself back to a regular good starting point so I can go back the next day to train again. With the other systems like Flowbility and WEF Method, I've never taken any courses from them. FP, I haven't taken any courses from them. All that I've really seen from them is just on Instagram. I just wasn't as pulled. I wasn't drawn to them as much. And so I haven't explored their systems.
Can you maybe dive a little bit more into how Postural Restoration Institute helped you? I like this idea of a neutral baseline. It's actually something that I've been playing with a lot in terms of my own training, is finding that like that center to expand from, right? So once you've, what are some of the things that, you know, taking their courses, what are common issues that you find people have that hold them back from finding that neutral position? What do people maybe even misinterpret about that adequate neutral position to go from?
The most common thing that I've seen are folks who tend to be in a chronically extended state and not being able to go back in the other direction. Your anterior pelvic tilt is something that I see often. And so in postural restoration, they really talk about how our bodies are asymmetrical. And because we're asymmetrical, we tend to be heavier on one side, or parts of our diaphragm, right diaphragm is bigger than our left diaphragm. Things are just kind of positioned differently. So with posture restoration, they really honor the balanced asymmetry that we have. Like, we're not meant to be perfectly symmetrical, but we're meant to be able to alternate between both of our sides. And so with postural restoration, or PRI, they believe that because we are right side dominant or right side heavy, most of us, unless you have that really rare case of situs invertis, we tend to be little bit more right side dominant, where that left pelvis is more anteriorly tilted forward than the right pelvis. And there are different spectrums of this, because I always think that compensations, they can build upon each other. So like if we start with, sure, we're right side dominant, and then yeah, my left pelvis is more tipped forward than my right pelvis. Sometimes you can have folks who they're here in order to keep moving, keep breathing, keep walking, they'll also start to tip forward on their right side, and they end up with a bilateral anterior pelvic tilt, which will affect the position of your rib cage and affect positioning of the stuff that are surrounding the areas. So to go back to your question, common things I see are anterior pelvic tilt, especially anterior pelvic tilt on both sides, and just being chronically extended here. Sometimes when folks are in an anterior pelvic tilt, they'll tend to kind of tighten up through the back. And so you'll see like really tight glutes as well. That's another thing that I see. And so a really big thing that I look for with my clients is like, are you at an excessive tilt? Do you know how to go back in the other way? Does your body even feel safe going back in the other way? Can you use the right muscles to help you get some more posterior pelvic tilt? Or can you get the right muscles going to help you regain flexion? And it's not to say that like we should have a flat back all the time. Our pelvis has, I think, 90 degrees of variation, and neutral is actually at 30 degrees of a tilt. But the issue is if we are more than 30 and then we kind of get stuck there.
Yeah. So do you work with... Go ahead.
I was just going to say they have a... It's a big rabbit hole. You can get into a really big rabbit hole with PRI. I don't feel like I know enough to really talk on their behalf. But the basic things that I know have been so helpful for me, because I do so much extension-based movement in parkour. It helps me not get stuck here and helps me not get stiff. If you are here, it's really hard to rotate, and we all know that you need rotation in order to move. Yeah. Sorry, Will, what were you saying?
So you work with clients at the moment. Is there like a population? Obviously, you work with parkour athletes, I'm assuming.
Not actually. Like to work with folks who are finished with PT, and then they don't feel like they're quite the same.
PT being physiotherapy or?
Yes, physical personal therapy. Personal
training. Yeah, okay.
Physical therapy, yeah. So I like to get folks like they hurt themselves, they've gone to their PT, they're cleared by their PT, but they don't feel like they're back to themselves. And so I like to clean up the work from there. I probably right now spend about 20 hours a week of personal training and movement coaching, where I'm helping people get out of chronic pain and helping people improve their athletic performance. And then the other half of my week, 20 to 25 hours, I spend coaching parkour. So then it helps me not feel burnt out in both directions. Cause then I can, when I'm coaching people, I'm like, cool, I'm really focusing on you. I'm trying to figure out why things are, I'm trying to make you like move better. But then when I'm coaching parkour, I can kind of take that lens away a little bit and focus on like trying to teach an actual skill. And at that moment, while I'm coaching parkour, if you jump and then your knee feels funky, I like, it's not something that I have to immediately think about. Like, I don't have to stop what we're doing and then try to address your knee, because my job right now in that moment is to teach you these parkour techniques. If you want to work on your knee issues another time, then we can do that, or like we can set up something for that. But I'm here right now to coach parkour. And so that's been helpful in preventing burnout. Even though I'm working the same amount of hours, or even more amount of hours than I used to just training.
So when you're getting these people who are just out of, you know, they were cleared by their physiotherapist, but they still aren't feeling 100% themselves. Why do you think that they're cleared in the first place? And then what work hasn't been done by these physiotherapists that you're ending up having to do with them?
A lot of the work that I have to do with folks who have been cleared is looking at the way that they breathe and checking to see if they're stuck in a really sympathetic state where they don't know how to come down and relax. Another thing that I see often from folks who've gotten cleared is that the PT will work on a specific muscle group and not look at the body as a whole. And so, sure, you tore your ACL, like, your physical therapist got you to learn how to extend your knee all the way. And then they're like, oh, cool, you can extend your knee all the way. You can walk, go at it, have fun. But obviously at that time, those patients don't really know how to use their body cohesively as one unit. And so that's where I like to come in and teach folks how to not only like use their body, but start to sense their body. Because I feel like also with folks in chronic pain, they will dissociate from themselves and not want to feel the things that they should feel. And sometimes that's more than half the battle. It's like, do you feel this muscle when we're doing this movement? No. Okay, let's figure out why you don't feel that. And let's try to get you to be more grounded and get you to understand like what you should be feeling. Hmm. I think that's something that I often see as well.
So I share similar frustrations with how that works. So basically, like, you know, restoring range of motion is, you know, let's say a knee injury. Let's get terminal extension and that's the goal, right? So I share that frustration, but you were mentioning sympathetic tone. How would you assess that on somebody? Like someone comes in, obviously most people in chronic pain are probably high in sympathetic tone, but how would you go about seeing a regular person and assessing that, yes, that tone is high and sympathetic, and on the counter end, parasympathetic, how would you see where somebody's at?
Definitely. For me right now, I can look for clues. I think a really good way to also take a look at it, which I haven't delved too deep into, is taking a look at heart rate and heart rate variability things. Mm. Haven't gone into that rabbit hole yet, maybe eventually soon. But some clues that I see right now is I'll have somebody, I'll look at how they're breathing. I'll look how they're breathing sitting. I'll look how they're breathing laying down. Especially when they're laying down, a clue that will indicate that someone is in a more chronically sympathetic state is that rib flare. And then, so say the ribs are flared upwards and they're breathing and those ribs are not moving. They're just like stuck up there. So that's one indication that those folks are kind of just up here all the time. Another thing that I take a look at is if folks are nose breathing or if they're mouth breathing. Another one is I like to sometimes take a Bolt score to see kind of how they react to being in a more stressed state and how that goes. In terms of like, how can I tell if folks are able to get into a more parasympathetic state? I feel like if they're able to take a proper inhalation and a proper exhalation, that should be able to stimulate a more parasympathetic state. But I think the bigger indicator, which I do need to delve more into, is being able to study folks' heart rates. And so are they able to get their heart rate down? And are they also able to get their heart rate up? Like how big is your heart rate variability? You should have a large heart rate variability. And I think that's a good indicator of whether someone can go through this sympathetic and parasympathetic state. Because again, like we want to be able to be here so we can go on both ends. Like I'm now just realizing that I'm just a lot about a neutral person. Like I love neutrality because that gives you wiggle room in both ends. Because you don't want to be on either this parasympathetic end and then not be able to like explode out into something. Like that's another issue too.
So when you're looking for, when I'm just going to rewind it back to this thing that you said about how your strength training should be something that you don't have to think about and it should translate to the other practices that you have. When you're training yourself for parkour, you're giving recommendations for parkour athletes to develop strength. How do you do that where, you know, prior you're like, well, you know, with weightlifting, for example, it kind of translated to clunkier movement and you obviously don't want that, right? And so when you're thinking about, okay, well, what are the qualities and attributes that you're training for in a strength training setting for parkour athletes? And then how do you actually translate that practically so that it doesn't create movement clunkiness and it does actually promote that, you know, effortless translation into movement without having to think about it?
I think that for parkour athletes, most of them already have a baseline of how they're moving. And so unless it's really egregious, I don't really like to coach them on this is how you need to run. This is how your foot needs to come down. For those type of athletes, we'll it's more of like, back. Can I,
yeah, she'll be back.
In like how OKF says, can I strengthen these guess, attributes? So then they show up countdown. As byproducts in your actual movement. So I take a lot of what OKF does in strength training thoughts, and a lot of,
while we're waiting for her to come back.
What no, it's just all interesting stuff, right? Like, I have a different take on a few of the things, but I always like hearing
other things that I take from just various other experiences,
right? So, really like, I guess very interesting stuff. And parkour is I'm always interested in it. Amateur parkour,
feel certain muscles while you're in certain positions. Like, can you even feel your hamstrings while you're in a split stance?
I would say I'm amateur.
Feel your hamstrings and your glutes lengthening while you're holding a single stance position. So being able to feel those types of things while you're doing your strength training,
started doing any training whatsoever. Me and
attributes focusing on being able to really target stuff that you want to be able to work while you're doing your actual movement is kind of how I go about things.
Coming back in, yeah.
So definitely take a lot from OPF.
Yeah, when I was in high school, I got into parkour, and so a lot of it was
on attributes that will lead to the byproducts that you want to see.
So it's like, I have to climb on these things, and I have to jump on things, and my friend and I were just kind of obsessed with what's the highest roof that we can jump off and not die.
I don't know if y'all are still there.
So we were learning, not only how to land in these deep squat positions so that we, we're absorbing force, but then it was like, oh, it's not just about the force absorption, it's about the transference of force after you land. Can you carry that momentum a little bit further? So I started learning, it's like I'm landing in like a partial squat, but then letting my body momentum go forward and I tuck out into a roll. So that force is, kind of following through and transferring through my body as opposed to just being completely and totally absorbed. So that that was my exposure. Like when I was a little like twerp in high school, probably like 18, 19 years old.
Yeah. It's
even a bit younger.
I think I want to take formal lessons in it at some point. Cause I like to roll around. I like to jump off things. And I think landing mechanics are huge. Being able to absorb land, fall, I should say.
We lost you, but you're
sorry,
back.
I lost you.
Okay, well,
I don't know what you heard me last say.
We just started, so let's start from the beginning. So what you think parkour athletes need, and then how we translate that in a strength training setting.
Gotcha. I don't usually coach parkour athletes in how they should run or how they should jump. A lot of parkour athletes already have a set way of doing that. And I don't necessarily want to mess with that unless it's really egregious. And like they're jumping with their toes out super out or something, or it just looks really, really off. Then maybe I'll say, yeah, listen, can you try to land with straighter feet? That's kind of the extent I go when I'm coaching parkour athletes. In terms of strength training, I take a lot from OKF in terms of developing certain attributes like lateral stability, being able to own a neutral position. And I also take a lot from
sorry about that. I was shutting off my phone there.
Oh no, you're all good.
Yeah.
I take a lot from OKF, like being able to have lateral stability, being able to understand that you need to own neutral stability. I take a lot from the stuff that I've learned in the past, being able to have a good sense of core stability, being able to, are you able to lengthen your glutes? Are you able to, do you know how to internally rotate by using the proper internal rotation muscles? And so that I think I've gotten a lot from posture restoration. And so they go a lot into like specific muscles that do specific movements, like, oh, these muscles help you with like how your femur rotates on your acetabulum. These muscles help how your acetabulum rotates on your femur. And so I've kind of taken that and tried to put that into certain strength training movements that I do, and getting folks to understand, like, when you do this movement, I need you to feel this, this, and this. And so we focus on that, and then that, as of right now, has been translating really well into their unconscious movement.
How do you personally measure whether or not those inputs are working and translating in the way that you want?
I do an assessment of your squat, toe touch, run, walk. I also just do a few basic table tests, like testing adduction drop tests, abduction lift tests. And so I'll take those measurements and try to put them together. A lot of what I do, because I had a heavy Goda influence, is I do take a look at a lot of video, and I do a lot of screen recording, and I do a lot of side-by-side things, and I look at what that looks like. There is a downside to it, because your eyes can fool you, and like lighting and like, you know, just a lot of different things. So I try to have some objective measurements, but I do have some subjective measurements based off of the knowledge that I know and the knowledge that I can see if something is off or something is looking a little bit better.
I have a burning question. I kind of didn't want to ask it, but I have to, because with Foster Restoration Institute, the ilium, the SI joint moving one side exclusively, right? So I see a lot of video where they're showing the SI joint basically come out. Now in the office, I've seen hundreds and hundreds of patients. I don't really see that. So what am I like? Is it the soft tissue moving? Is it the muscles pulling that side? Or is it the actual SI joint moving itself? Because you mentioned earlier that one side coming out compared to the other, and I do see a lot of it online. So how do you look at that?
It depends. I think folks can present themselves in a lot of ways. I know that Posture Restoration, they have a lot of objective table tests that helps the practitioners get a more holistic view or a balanced view of what's actually going on. I think that joint position will dictate muscle function. And so I do think that the joints are in a funky position that will cause some muscles to not function as optimally. I think as humans, we're so adaptable. So if we are kind of lopsided, then we'll figure out how to work with that lopsidedness. And then that might progress into something else, which might progress into a different presentation. Yeah, I really would love if y'all got a trained PRT, posture restoration trained person on. I think that y'all would have a lot of fun with them.
Cool.
Yeah, we're going to have one down. That's high on the list. And I had actually a few messages asking us to dive deeper into the system. And I'm always just more fascinated by people's personal experiences, the applications of things as much as the theory itself, right? Because you're boots on the ground working with people, and you're seeing the things present themselves over and over and actually applying it and being like, hey, this worked, you know, like we used this approach. This is what we got them to focus on, and this was the tangible, producible results. That's something that I'm always super, super fascinated with. As it pertains to technique, what are some technical considerations? I mean, I know that there's a huge variety of skills within parkour, but when you're trying to teach someone technique and not overthink, right? Like have that ability to like, trust in what their body's doing and to do it correctly. How do you both teach someone how to be technically precise while also not getting too wrapped up in like, oh, my body has to be here, here, and here, and here, when you have to think of like 20 different things when you're first learning a technique?
Are you talking about like parkour technique specifically?
Yeah. Yeah. What you teach.
Okay. It's going to be a lot of I think number one thing that I teach my students first is that when you're running into a wall, you need to have your feet in front of you. Many a time have I seen people try to run and then like run up a wall, and they try to go with their hands to grab the top. And then what ends up happening is they use their hands, they jump, they try to grab the top of the wall, and then they like body slam into a wall. So a number one thing with parkour is learning how to get your feet in front of you whenever you're going to a wall type of thing, or even just when jumping. You want to be able to jump and have your feet out in front of you. You want to be able to see where your feet are going when you're landing. So one of the first things that I teach folks is how to wall pounce. So it's essentially learning how to jump to a wall, hit the wall with the balls of your feet, and then be able to drop down and come down to the floor. I think that is a really, really big fundamental thing that people have to learn how to do. When they're doing that, I try to tell people to make sure that when they hit the wall, they need to hit with the ball of their feet. Don't hit with your heel. Don't hit with your toes. It has to be the ball of your foot, because that's where you're going to have the most range of motion in terms of like, because if I'm, this is what you're going to do this year. Like if I, oh no, you all can't see me.
But we could see it.
Yeah, there you go. So if I'm like landing on my heels, I can't really go anywhere. If I'm landing on my toes, that's just going to hurt. If I'm on the ball of my foot, I have so much more range. I'm able to use my ankles. I'm able to use my knees. I'm able to use my hips in order to balance. Hmm. And it's just also where you're going to have it's where you can absorb impact the best is going to be at the balls of your feet. And sometimes that's also just strange for people to do. They're used to landing on their heels. They're just not used to jumping up at a wall generally. In parkour, there's a lot of things that you have to override your brain and be like, oh yeah, I'm just going to run into this wall. Like, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. So backtracking, number one thing is teach people how to get their feet out in front of them and learn how to use the ball of their feet. Once we can do that, once they understand like, yeah, my feet contact have to come first, then from there, it's like slowly progressing skills to suit the student. Usually in the beginner's class, I'll start folks off with that wall pounce, learning how to vault, basic vaults, how to get over obstacles, safety vaults, speed vaults, dash vaults, different ways to get over stuff. And then that's generally where we like to start off with vaults, learning how to wall pounce, learning how to run up a wall, and then learning how to hang off a wall, which is called a cat hang.
I don't know
if I answered your question.
Yeah, yeah, it absolutely does. What I kind of gathered is like you're trying to develop fundamental habits first, and then from it's almost like the neutral position, right? It's like you want to make sure that you have this correct set of habits for where you're going to be able to branch off from in terms of other technical skills. So you want it, you want the foundations to be as unconscious as possible, and the fundamentals to be as like automatic as possible. And then once you have that base, it would be almost easier to build and safer to build off into more technical skills.
Yeah, exactly. Your reflective listening is awesome.
Thank you.
It's a strong suit. It's ninja.
It's my only role on this podcast.
So yeah, so if someone, like say this is the wall and they're here and they're trying to jump and then hang off the wall, like we'll start close. All right, cool. You can hit the wall with your feet and then grab the top. We'll go a little bit farther. Make sure you hit the wall with your feet and then grab the top. And then once, like you said, they have that foundation down, they and have it automatic, that's when they can put more power into it and go for like a bigger running cat. But they know their nervous system should know like, oh, I need to do this first type of thing. Yeah. So it is, I think parkour should be a lot of building those types of foundations. So then you can go into those harder movements where it's higher risk. There is a large, higher risk. So you don't want to get that basic thing down. You don't want to have, you don't want to do that.
I'm loving this train. Actually, these tips are gold and can be applied elsewhere as well. What about landing, breaking a fall? Where do you start with that? And is that obviously a foundational thing that you teach?
Yeah, it's something that I like to teach. I teach three different ways to take impact. The first way would be a shoulder roll or a parkour roll. That's essentially, it's not a somersault, because a somersault, you'd be going over your head, going over your spine. A shoulder roll, instead of going over your spine, it's more of a diagonal path from like here down to your opposite hip. So that's one way to absorb impact, is through a shoulder roll. Another way that I teach is called a transfer Kong or a QM. That's essentially when they land down on their feet, absorb some impact with their legs, and then use their hands to kind of push themselves away and push all their energy away to the side, and they'll hop off from there. The last way that I usually teach is in the gym that I work at, we call it a safety tap. And it is essentially just jumping down and then landing on the balls of your feet, using your hands to absorb the impact as well. And there's like two trains of thoughts to it. Like you can safety, we teach the kids this way, safety tap, like they're landing like a Spider-Man. We teach them this way because we've seen a lot of kids who don't have good trunk control. And so I land like this when I do that movement, but with kids who don't have good trunk control, they'll do boom. They'll straight up knee their face. Yeah. So if they have their legs out here, and sometimes adults too, who don't have good trunk control, I tell them to land like this, and I'll you know, it's not anything bad. It's kind of like what that person is able to do. Like, this is still a pretty safe landing. But for my comfort, I like to land like this, because this is also the way that I train, and with this like knees being forward type of thing.
Mm. So, you know, Kidori, obviously, you know who he is.
Yeah.
True. Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah, he is. And I always watch his landing, and I hear the go-to people being like, look, it's a double bow. And then some other people are like, no, his knees are in. What is your take on, maybe you can show us exactly what he's doing there to land, if possible.
I think he's landing as neutral as he can.
Yeah.
And then as that impact's coming down, that's what, if his knees come out, that's what it's doing. It's just from that energy that's coming down. It's not him trying to bring his knees open.
Yeah.
He's just trying to absorb landing with his legs. Yeah.
Awesome.
So I wouldn't say it's a double bow. I wouldn't say it's like straight. I think it's, I think he lands as neutral as he can. And then all that energy is going to dispense itself somewhere else.
Do you think there's a mechanical advantage to either knees in or knees out? You know, when you're teaching the Spider-Man versus that more neutral knee position that you have, you know, let's assume perfect trunk control. Do you think that there's a mechanical advantage to one over the other?
I think ideally you'd be able to land with your knees a little bit more straight, because it's going to be putting you in a more neutral position and you'll have more wiggle room to move from. When I watch professional parkour athletes, I would say most of the time they land with their knees straight. And that's just what I've observed.
Mm. Strong neutral.
Yeah, I know. it's been working for me.
Do you ever see obviously you probably follow some, you know, professionals who are doing some wild stuff. Do you ever see someone who's way out of the box and you're like, how is he doing that? Or how's she doing that? In terms of parkour, do people usually land or move similarly?
I think there's a little bit of a spectrum, because in parkour there are a lot of different offshoots of it. Like in parkour, you can have a purist who is like, oh, get to point A to point B as fast as you can, and you can have someone who's more stylistic and is more into free running, where maybe they'll do more tricking. And so what folks like to do kind of dictates the way that they move too. And so somebody who's really into tricking, like they're, because of tricking, their movement is going to be a lot of more externally rotating. Like it's more biased towards external rotation, because that's what they also do. They do a lot of spins, they do a lot of twists, a lot of like landing and taking off in like this open position here. Whereas if you maybe watch someone who's more into like speed, their movement might be a little bit different. And that kind of goes along with what you see in your day-to-day sports, like how someone in soccer or whatever runs different than their other teammate. But because there are different offshoots that stem from parkour, I think that also, it also influences the way that they move in a specific way. But generally, like, good parkour technique is pretty universal. Mm. In the terms of like, you're doing a big jump, hope you get your feet in front of you first.
Right. So obviously you're seeing where your feet are landing when your feet are in front of you. What are some of the, how do you mitigate the risk of injury in a sport that is just like rife with that much, you know, potential for injury? Like how are you prepping your body, not only from a technique perspective, but like in terms of a body resiliency perspective? Like obviously, like you mentioned before, there's so much technique involved. Doesn't matter how strong and prepared you are. If you do it wrong, you can screw yourself up. So obviously there's a lot of practice, but from the perspective of preparing your body, what are some of the major considerations that you would say before you're getting into this? Hey, maybe start working on this.
I would make sure that you do have a good baseline of strength and mobility. If you are a really stiff human being, it is going to be a little bit harder for you to parkour and to stay safe. Not to say that folks get around it. I think the folks that get around it, they really work on their parkour technique to minimize the impact that they receive from doing a lot of the things that they do. There are a lot of injuries in parkour. There are a lot of ACL tears in parkour, especially among the female parkour athletes. There's quite a bit. For me personally, what has been working for me is doing what I've learned through all of these various movement systems. I strength train on a good, perfect week. I'll strength train 2 times a week. I'll parkour train 3 times a week, and then I'll have a recovery day once a week. Yeah, so in an ideal world, that's what I do. Right now, it's been more of like I'll do parkour 4 days a week. I'll strength train once a week, and then yeah. But I can tell when I'm neglecting my body, because then things start to feel funky. But I am so happy that I have these different tools to get my body to a good starting place. Not to say fix my body, but like to ensure that, oh, okay, if my back feels weird, if my shoulder feels weird, I know what I can do to help it feel better so I can continue to train. That's been a really nice relief from my brain.
So for you personally, what is your style of parkour? I see you climbing quite a bit. Maybe I'm just biasing what I'm looking at, but is there a particular style that you're into and that you teach?
I love skill. I love in parkour, in competitions, there's usually 3 different categories. One category is speed. Another category is freestyle. And then the last category is skill. Skill is parkour skill base. They'll tell you, oh, you have to, the challenge is you have to stride from this ledge to this ledge, hit the wall with this foot, and then grab the wall like this. And so they'll give you different challenges. And I like having the idea of challenges to complete. And I like the idea of like, oh, you have to be skilled and technical in parkour to do these, or else you can't do them or you would get hurt. So my big thing is skill, and that's what I like to compete in. I'm going to compete in a national championship next week, which is going to be fun.
Very cool. Can we catch that on YouTube or anywhere?
I think they might live stream it. If they do, I'll send both of you a link.
Please do. Awesome.
Yeah. So I am more of a skill person. I also did speed this year. But speed is not my jam. I've realized this year I can do well in it, but how I feel after, I don't like how I feel after, because I always feel like I didn't do a good job. I always feel like disappointed with my performance, because usually in speed, you'll get like either one run or maybe you'll get 2 runs. And they'll time you for whichever run that you do. And the faster one is the time that you get. But I found that this year I did speed. I did pretty well, but like I was always unsatisfied with the times that I got. And then you have to be very bold in your movement when you're doing speed. When you hesitate, that's when things can go wrong, or that's when you can get hurt. With skill, it's the same thing. Like you have to fully commit, but there is a little bit more room and a lot more time for you to think about what you're going to do. Whereas speed is just like go. I think next year I'm going to try and do some freestyle and see how that goes.
And what, so that what
freestyle
is,
yeah.
Sorry. I was just going to ask what freestyle was. Yeah. Like what differentiates that?
Freestyle is the more stylistic things that you see. So like flips and twists and like flowy types of movement. It's almost like a dance in a way. Nice. And so in parkour competitions, they'll give you a space. So they're like, oh, you have the whole gym. You have to make a 15 to 45 second line. And it's supposed to show like how you use the space, how creative you are, how well are the moves executed, are the moves difficult to do? And so you get judged in those different categories and you get a score usually out of 10.
Cool. So it's you're given like some constraints. You have to determine your own line. You have to determine your style. And that's a lot of creative pressure. And how much time do you have to plan your line? How much, like, it's interesting because you almost have to visualize it first,
and then you have to actually execute it. So that there's the, and how much time do you have to put that together in a competition setting?
It depends from competition to competition. Some competitions will give you 30 minutes. Some will give you an hour. I've been to a competition where they let the freestyle athletes practice for an hour, and then they had another practice 2 hours later, and then they were the last to perform.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. It was wild. But it depends on the competition and their rules. But it is a lot of pressure, and you go one at a time. Mm. So everyone's watching you do your line.
Very cool. Yeah.
How do you, because the hesitation point is a fascinating one for me. Obviously, hesitation in a sport like parkour can cost you a lot more than style points, right? It can cost you a lot. You can get injured if you hesitate. How do you work on the confidence or the self-trust to eliminate that tendency to hesitate?
For me, it's a lot of knowing that I have a foundation. And I really lean into that. If I'm going to go for this really big jump, I know that, like, say I'm jumping off a rail, it's up at height. I know that I have good enough technique. I just need to do the same thing and then it'll be fine. So it's a lot of, for me, just knowing I have a good foundation.
Right. So confidence in the practice, confidence in the repetition, having it be so second nature that you don't have room to doubt yourself.
Yeah. And I think it's also taken some times where I did doubt myself and like seriously injure myself, where it's like, oh yeah, you have to full commit, full right. Sends only is what I've been told.
Full sends only. I like that.
So no. what's your favorite maneuver at the moment, and what's something you're working on that you're almost there, but don't quite have it yet?
My favorite like parkour skill right now is cats. I love jumping to walls and hanging off of walls. There are different ways that you can get into cats. You can vault into a cat. You can jump off of something into a cat. You can run up into things into a cat. So my biggest thing are cat leaps and things of that sort. Something that I'm working on is still related to a cat, but they're called pole cats. And so like, imagine, like there's a pole here, you jump to the pole and land on the pole like this.
Cool.
Yeah. They're silly. But they're showing up a lot more in these competitions, and I don't like to work on them because I've shinned myself lots of times. But again, it comes back to like technique, like can you get your feet in the right place and then practice that? And then when you go for these bigger ones, feet in the right place, knowing how to take that impact and learning how to absorb. And so that's something that I had to really work on. Yeah. And I guess maybe another technique that I'm also working on are trying to develop better Kongs. Kong vaults are the ones where they dive hand first and then they bring their knees in between their arms. Mm-hmm. There are different types of Kongs that you can do. You can do like double Kongs. You can do a Kong landing on a ledge, and the way that you approach that Kong is different depending on what you're going to be landing on, whether you're going to be landing on a ledge that's higher or a ledge that's lower, or if you're going to be landing on a wall. Just lots of different things that you can adjust and tweak to complete the skill.
Cool. That point about like hitting your shin and then just like not wanting to do the thing. I think that it's challenging because when you do injure yourself, that's such a strong nervous system signal. When you do something and you experience pain, all of a sudden your whole nervous system is like, avoid this, you know, like it's trying to protect you. You develop these like neural circuitry to protect yourself from repeating that pain. So like having the repetition to trust yourself and override that like instinctive desire to protect yourself, that's work too. Like that's a challenge. I think the cultivation of courage through like physical repetition is like, that's such an interesting, fascinating thing. Cause you're battling your instinct. Once you do injure yourself, once you do hurt yourself.
I agree. What I love about parkour too, is that it makes you more comfortable being uncomfortable. Mm. And I feel like that's such a great skill for kids to learn. And I enjoy coaching the kids too, because I think parkour is just such a great, all around great things for kids to learn how to do. Good for risk assessment, great for proper body movement, good for learning how to overcome like these mental battles that you have. Because there are some parkour challenges that are like, oh, this is not a big jump, but it's like a big mental thing.
So yeah,
and it's just practice. Go for it, Will.
Is there like a skill or a tribute, or maybe even a couple of them, that you would say, I can't believe athletes or the regular weekend warrior, or maybe even kids, don't know how to do this. And if they just learn this, it would be very valuable. Maybe like break falling or something along those lines. Is there something you can think about there?
Getting over an obstacle without using your elbows and your knees.
Interesting. Yeah. Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. So like, say an obstacle is like, here's the person, the obstacle is about waist height. Like a lot of folks have trouble like knowing how to get over the thing. Mm-hmm. In parkour, you don't want to use your elbows and your knees, cause you don't want them on hard surfaces over time. It's going to hurt a lot. And I've seen some very interesting ways that people get over things. I think a good example is if you watch people do an obstacle course race, you'll see a lot of like, oh, that looks not great. That looks inefficient. Another fun place to see them too are like even sometimes military training stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting with parkour is that it started in France. I think David Bell's grandpa was in the military, and then he noticed that the indigenous folks, that they could move through the forest really, really well, while his men were so clunky and awkward moving through. And so he studied the way that these indigenous folks moved through, and developed a system from that of how to get over obstacles or how to traverse over things.
That's David Bell's grandfather?
I think so.
That's cool.
Don't quote me, but I think so.
I remember watching hours of David Bell footage. Like that was like one of the two things that got me into training in the first place were watching videos of David Bell move and watching Kung Fu videos of Shaolin monks. Those were like my two favorite like things. I was like, how do people do this? This is crazy.
Yeah. I agree. But yeah, getting over ledges, and then maybe we'll even just like learning how to climb over a wall or climbing over a fence.
That's awesome. Is there somewhere you'd steer, like, do you have a program yourself of like the basics of parkour, or is there something you would recommend along those lines there, or just watching footage, or how would you go along like somebody remote learning this?
If you don't have access to a parkour gym, there are tons of YouTube videos. That's a lot of how a lot of people have learned parkour, through YouTube videos. Tons and tons of tutorials through that. But I just recommend trying to find a coach. And even if they want to work remotely, I think it's better to have someone to support you. But definitely YouTube, tons of videos. If you can get to a gym, try to get to a gym to learn some stuff, or find a coach who will teach you how to do it outside. Doing stuff in a gym is also like way different than doing stuff outside. Because outside there's no soft mats, a lot more consequence outside. And the surfaces, you always have to check your surfaces, make sure that what you're jumping to is stable. Be safe type of thing.
As far as footwear is concerned, do you have any special recommendations or special considerations for, because obviously you'd want to have like a significant amount of grip, but do you have particular considerations for types of footwear you should do when you're free running or doing parkour?
Generally, you want shoes that have a rubber sole, so for the grip, and you want shoes that are able to bend really well at the toe box, because you're landing on the balls of your feet so much. Usually those two are just what I tell people to try and look out for. Rubber sole, and then toes that are toe box that's able to bend. We see a lot of folks try to do parkour in like foam shoes, and there's no grip with foam shoes. I've seen successful people do it too. But like really rigid shoes aren't the best either. But yeah.
You need that ball of the foot action going on.
Yeah, definitely.
So do you work with people online? Could they reach out to you and get lessons, or I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interest.
I currently work with people.
Oh no.
Okay. I currently don't work with people online. I'm based in Los Angeles. So if folks are ever in the LA area and they want to link up, I'm more than happy to. I just don't like to do online coaching very much. It's just not my jam. Yeah.
But you do have an awesome Instagram page, which I'm going to highly recommend people go check out. If you want to check out, what Anne is up to and you want to maybe peep what's going on, check out Newfangled Axes with an underscore between Newfangled and Axes. And I will include a link to Anne's Instagram in the description of this particular podcast. If you had any like encouraging words to people who wanted to start getting into this, like in terms of like if people are kind of on the fence about it, but they're like maybe unsure, they're lacking confidence, like how would you say it's like, hey, if you want to get into parkour, but like here's the approach.
Parkour is so scalable. Even if you think that you can't do anything, like you can scale something down. That's what I love about parkour. I think everyone can do it. I think that you can progress things in so many different ways. And just being able to, it's going to feel so great to be able to be in tune with your body and not at the mercy of your environment.
Mm.
Yeah, but definitely scalable. Parkour is scalable. You can do it. Like, you can do it.
So just start, even if you have your doubts.
Yeah, just start. Start small, start slow. The saying is what? Slow is smooth, and then smooth becomes fast.
Mm.
I like that. Yeah.
Cool. Well, guys, thank you for checking out the Art of Move podcast. If you want to learn more about Anne's work, you can go follow her at newfangled_axes on Instagram. Is there anywhere else online that people can find you?
That's going to be mostly it. That's going to be mostly it for now.
Okay, cool. So go check out Anne on Instagram. And then when you have that competition, we definitely want to get a link to that. Hopefully they stream that out on YouTube. Guys, if you're listening on YouTube, please like, comment, let us know what you thought of this episode. Let us know if you have any more questions about anything that we talked about. You can also message us on Instagram. I am at anthony.manuel, M-A-N-U-E-L-E. Will is at The Art of Move. We always love hearing your comments and what you want to hear about next. And thank you so much for hopping on with us and having a chat about this. This was like a really cool conversation. I like the practical application, the specific sport application of all the things that we talk about in general when the rubber meets the road. And it's less about just, you know, pure theory and you're actually out there doing it. I think that's like some of the most fun conversation that we always end up having.
Cool. Thank you so much, Will. And thank you so much, Anthony. I really appreciate your time.
That was amazing insight.
Yeah, this was a blast. I'm going to go start climbing on more things now. So
yeah, do it. It's so much fun. And it's nice to be a kid again. It's a shame that most playgrounds have the no adults unless you have children rule.
Right. That's fair.
I can see the reasoning.
A good place to start parkour are at college universities. Their stuff is intended for people to like walk around and sit on. And you'll find a lot of fun challenges at universities. That's usually where a lot of parkour people go when they go train outside, is they'll go to a local university.
You got the insider tips. Awesome.
There we go. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to go hunt down a university to go climb over and I'll tag you in all the videos of us doing that. So again, thank you so much for hopping on, guys. Thank you for listening to The Art of Move. If you're listening on Spotify, leave us a review, or iTunes, leave us a review, anything. Just, let us know what you thought, because we like your feedback and we like you being a part of the community. We value your input. Thanks for listening, guys. And we'll catch you on the next episode of The Art of Move.
Have a good one, guys.